Welcome in. It's episode number 53 of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast.
Wow, 53.
Did you like how I just went from being very excited to just winding down?
Is it because you had to speak my name out loud and doing that gives you great pain?
Tyler Mon, Anthony Masterson.
Anthony Masterson, like you're just...
I was thinking the other day, I think I introduced you on all
regurgitating it out.
I need to just start letting you introduce you. I need to start saying, like, I'm Tyler Mon.
And I'm Anthony Masterson.
And this is the Purple Dinosaur
and we're
podcast.
Two guys on the internet.
We're such idiots. Hey, welcome in. Welcome into the show. Episode number 53. We don't have any music for this week's show, so we're recording this now, and I don't know what I will have put in there. So
just
maybe we'll
do like a U2 song that's like really, really copyright heavy, or like a Taylor Swift song, and just say this like Apple Music.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not paying your royalties, lady.
So you know, what are they going to do? Plan. We're a free podcast. Oh,
exactly.
Sue us? Oh, okay, never
sue
mind.
Sue us for
never
no mind. Money?
Yeah.
Hey, today is the 53rd episode of this show, and we got a real doozy of a list.
Got a lot of winners here. I mean, Christian Friedrich is one of only two players to have ever held that number for more than a single season, so he's obviously the leader in the clubhouse. He's worn it since he came up in 2012. And Manny Del Carmen, Randy Flores, the other person who wore it for more than a year in 2009 and 2010. And then a bunch of people who I'm – listen, I would say this a lot for every one of these numbers. I have never heard of most of these people ever in my life. Corey Vance, Mike Porzio, Fred Rath, Mark Hutton, Joe Grahe, Bruce Walton, and Gary Wayne.
Wow.
Have you heard
Gary
of any
Wayne
of those
just was a guy who was named after two towns in Indiana.
Yes.
I guess. Mark Hutton I have heard of.
Okay.
Not a single other.
Right?
Porzio? Did you say Porzio?
Mike Porzio? Fred Rath?
What?
Like,
are these like replacement players?
1998?
are they playing the 95 exhibition games? Is that what we're talking about?
Oh, wow. God, if Fred
that
Rath would have been like a big guy, I'm sure Berman would have called him Fred Rath of Khan.
Oh, you know he would have, too.
Yeah.
You know he would have. Oh, and it would have made us all so angry. Hey, so welcome into the Christian Friedrich Memorial Edition of the Purple
By the
Dinosaur
way, Fred
Podcast.
Rath played two games for the Rockies. Gave up one run in 5 1/3. 169 ERA. Two strikeouts, two walks.
I think you'll love that. Like, having watched the Rockies for so long, you see situations where guys came up and, like, had success in very limited context. You're like, well, why didn't they give him more of a shot? Nobody else could pitch.
Yeah, pretty.
Why didn't Fred Rath get a shot? Fred Rath worked his entire damn life, and I will be a monkey's uncle if I don't carry the flag of Fred Rath's career.
Mike
what
Porzio.
Else did he have any other big league time?
Nope.
Good.
Just those two games.
That's good. He's like the Rockies' Moonlight Graham.
I mean, kind of. He had two games in 1998. His debut, July 29th, 1998. His last game, August 4th, 1998.
Wow.
He's also the son of Fred Rath.
Now,
and his
that
name is Fred
sort
Rath.
Of makes some sense.
His dad, Fred Rath, played in the 60s for the White Sox. A pitcher appeared in 8 total games, total ERA of 4.70, a record of 0-2. He was a fourth-round pick of the White Sox in the 1965 amateur draft. Thanks, Baseball Reference.
Fred Rath. Huh.
What a weird kind of lineage. You know, Fred Rath, like, and his dad, they both got – like legit cups of coffee, and that's pretty much it in the major leagues. But they both make major leagues.
What if they actually had cups of coffee too?
I'm sure they might have.
Oh no, he wasn't a free. He wasn't undrafted. He was a 29th round pick in 1991, out of Jefferson High School in Tampa, Florida. Drafted by the New York Yankees. Spent 7 seasons in the minor leagues. Did Fred Rath, and his playing days wrapped up after going. Ugh. In 2001, combined between AA New Haven and AAA Memphis in the St. Louis Cardinals organization, 4-5 with a 6.89 ERA in 28 games, 10 starts.
I feel like we've talked enough about Fred Rath right now. We didn't make the podcast. This is the Fred Rath
You know
what's
cool?
Memorial Edition.
Yeah, why don't we make it the Fred Rath Memorial Edition? Let's do it. The Moonlight Graham Memorial Edition of the show. Frederick, his middle name is Helsher.
Helsher.
H-E-L-S-H-E-R Rath Jr.
Huh.
All right, Fred.
All right, Fred.
Welcome aboard. Yeah. Somewhere, like somewhere, Fred Rath is out there right now.
Yeah.
He's doing something.
Yeah.
Presumably. I don't know. Maybe he's sleeping.
He's 42.
Yeah, like he's, you know, probably like a coach or like a player development guy, maybe a scout.
Who knows?
But
hey, Fred Rath, if you're listening, tweet at us, at Purple Dino Cast.
Hey, it got us the David Needs, son.
It did, actually.
Which was the weirdest thing ever. Yeah. So welcome in, then, the Fred Rath Memorial Edition of the show. Anthony already has, we very rarely prep for this podcast at all.
Clearly.
And today we actually have two very cool things coming up on the show. Number one, Benjamin Hockman from the Denver Post is going to be joining us to talk about his phenomenal nine-inning series, which is up on DenverPost.com.
So good.
We're going to talk a lot about that today. But, Anthony, take it away, because you had a fantastic idea for our topic today.
Well, there's been a lot of chatter online over the last couple of weeks, and this goes back even farther. But the Rockies have been struggling lately. There's no way around that. And a lot of people are starting to get on the fire Walt Weiss train, and that's fine. I have no qualms with that whatsoever. But they point to Weiss's terrible lack of bullpen management, his lineups, and whatever. They just don't like him as a manager. That's fine. He has not been a particularly good manager this year at all. But in my experience over the last couple of weeks when I was in Cincinnati talking with Pete Rose was very famously a player manager in his final playing days with the Phillies. And I asked him point blank when we were doing our prep for the All-Star game, saying, do you think that, or with the Reds too, I should say, do you think that a player manager could exist in today's game? And he said, absolutely not. And so I asked him what his biggest reason was behind that. And he said, because it takes too much massaging of the media today, in addition to all your other duties as a manager, that you really can't spend your time being taken and being pulled in so many directions right now that a manager has to. He's got to be the guy who has to talk to the media for an extended period of time during the day. He's got to, you know, set the lineup, do scouting reports, you know, even throw bullpens, work with hitters, work with pitchers. A guy like Pete Rose would want to be working with hitters constantly and, you know, trying to mitigate your time in certain ways and delegate to everybody else. He said that right now, with the salaries that the players have right now, a lot of guys don't like to take instruction as well, which, you know, you can debate that. It's another debate in and of itself. But that to be a manager, you have to know every single one of your players individually. You have to know what guys need to get kicked in the rear, what guys need to be coddled, what guys need to be left alone, what guys need to be constantly helped. And even in his article that Tom Verducci wrote, a fascinating road trip story with Pete Rose from Vegas to L.A. Over the last month or so, came out, I think, in the last edition of Sports Illustrated. Verducci asked him if he could even manage in today's game just in general. And he says he would love to. But then Verducci asked him, what about if the front office said that there was going to be some kind of metrics being thrown down and saying, hey, you should probably think about playing this guy in this situation or this guy in this part of the lineup? He says, no, I couldn't do that because I want to be able to look at my guys and be able to know what they can accomplish on the field. And he can only do that, he says, by watching them play on a day-to-day basis. And as a player manager, that'd be very difficult. So I guess a two-part question here, Tyler. One, do you think Pete Rose is right? Do you think a player manager could succeed in this day and age? And the second part of that would be, who on the Rockies do you think could take over as player manager if they do summarily fire Walt Weiss during the season this year?
I love this question. I love this topic. I do sort of think that there's probably too much now that goes into all of the duties of being a manager to make it feasible, to make it realistic. But I think that the Rockies actually have a handful of guys who could possibly fit that bill. So I'm going to throw a couple of names at you. I think, honestly, catchers, obviously, they say make the best managers.
Yes.
And Nick Hundley, to me, seems like the type of guy who could do it because of his mentality, because of his mindset, because, you know, he's not the type of guy who's afraid to call out Mark Kislin when Kislin walks into the clubhouse. And, you know, that's what I like about somebody like Hundley. But I think in this scenario, Michael McHenry would be a very interesting choice because he's not the everyday guy, but he's very bright. He's very likable. He's good with the media. He's good with his teammates. And he seems like he is a pretty intelligent baseball mind. So to go the catcher route, I think I would go with Mike McHenry in that scenario. But the guy who, maybe it's because I have like the world's largest man crush on him, but the guy who I would
Forrest
want
Wall?
In this
Come
spot,
on.
Forrest Wall, Adam Ottavino.
Okay.
I think would be phenomenal.
A bullpen guy? Okay, I could see it.
Extraordinarily intelligent. Adam is probably the smartest athlete I would say I've ever interviewed. And very introspective, very understanding of not just what's going on around him, but his place in that. I think that lends itself well to being a manager because I think he's been used in such a variety of roles. He was a starter throughout his career in the minor leagues, came up to the major leagues, basically made his first professional appearances as a reliever at the big league level, and then worked his way into a bullpen role, very successful with the Rockies. Then he turned into a closer. He's seen so much, and he kind of knows how he fits into the wide mold of everything, that self-awareness I think is something that you very much need to have to be a manager. And I feel like, again, not a guy who plays every day, I think he would be a very intriguing option for that.
Yeah, and I kind of like the fact that it would be a reliever because, yes, you're an integral part of the team in a lot of ways, but at the same time, you're not the cleanup hitter. You're not the ace. You're a guy who can watch the game. You can watch the game from afar. You can kind of dissociate yourself and see what is working from the bullpen, what is not. Of course, you have to be in the dugout, though, at the same time. And it'd be really kind of funny. Like, hey, man, all right, I got to go get warmed up and then run out from the dugout to the bullpen.
Just sprint out between innings.
Yeah, and just leave your bullpen.
I got to put myself in. Hang on, guys.
Like that. I mean, of course, could be very interesting considering one of the things that a manager can really control in the game is his use of the bullpen. So would he overwork himself or underwork himself in favor of somebody else? I think it's a fascinating conversation.
Put yourself into a game and you blow it,
yeah, then you have to answer
the questions as the manager or as the athlete. And that sounds so much fun.
Yeah.
Sounds great. All right, Adam, when you put yourself in there in the eighth, what was the thought process? Well, you know, I just really felt like Adam could get it done.
Yeah.
And,
go straight Ricky Henderson on it.
First and third person. Yeah, go straight Ricky Henderson on it.
Yeah, Pete
but
Rose,
anyway.
Pete Rose was the last guy to do it, 84 to 86 with the Reds. So it's fascinating. I think, you know, if you want to go the superstar route, I think because a lot of those guys have been superstars. Frank Robinson did it. Joe Torre wasn't a superstar, but he was a very solid, well-respected player. He did it with the 77 Mets. Robinson with the Indians in 75 and 76.
For a second, I thought you were going to say he did it with the 76ers, and I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, no, he's a really multi-talented guy. You give him the best players in baseball, he can win you a World Series.
Yeah.
I think a guy like Tulo could be an interesting candidate because he's somewhat brusque with the media. He'll do his interviews, but he doesn't really give them too much. We know that he likes working with the players and with the hitters, especially on the team. You know, we always hear about in the offseason about him inviting all of the young players that he would like to his place in Vegas and them doing crazy workouts.
And he works with a lot of young guys, too. He's done his work there, obviously, with Jason Giambi. But I know Joey Gallo worked with him, for example, last year. So it's not just that he works with his teammates, but he works with a lot of young guys. So I think you're right. He kind of has that coaching mentality sometimes.
Well, and I also think that, despite what a lot of his critics would say, I think he loves being a Colorado Rocky. I think he loves being in Denver. And whenever they draft somebody new, he's always one of the first people to reach out. Brendan Rodgers has already said that Tulo has reached out to him on a number of occasions. Thomas Harding, our good pal from Rockies.com, wrote an article that says, Tulo gave me some pretty helpful hints, Rodgers said. I have his phone number and we talk a little bit. He asked how I'm doing. He gave me some helpful tips to always have fun and play hard because someone's always watching. You know, that kind of stuff for a young player, you always like to hear that. And I think Tulo has gone above and beyond when it comes to working with the young players and working with his teammates. And I think he could be a very decent candidate. Now, I will say that when we talk about how to be a player manager, and when I've talked about it with some of the former players that I've worked with on MLB Whip Around, even from Pete to Frank Thomas to Mark Swinney, CJ Nitkowski, they always say that pitchers make terrible managers. And I never really thought about it much, but you go run through the number of major league pitchers who have had a lot of overarching success as managers in the big leagues, it's not a lot, especially for an extended period of time. John Farrell, right now, he won a World Series in his first year. But, you know, everyone's always got an excuse saying, oh, well, that was Francona's team, whatever. You know, Bud Black had a lot of success with the Padres, but he was just let go. You know, they're saying a lot of guys, they don't believe that pitchers can be good managers because they don't play the game every day. They don't see it enough. And these, of course, hitters talking. So don't shoot the messenger here. This is just what they say. I thought that was kind of a fascinating stance on it as well. I never really thought about it, that a pitcher can't be a great manager. And even I brought up Tommy Lasorda, and they said, like, oh, he rarely made the big leagues, and he still hasn't managed a big league player on his own, or a Hall of Fame player on his own. So, like, okay, well, I'm not gonna get into that debate with you, Mr. Rose. But yeah,
people hate Tommy Lasorda.
I don't think they're friendly.
Wow.
I mean, why would they?
I did not know.
You know?
I did not know.
No, I mean, you know, Pete was fiercely loyal to his National League brethren, of course. But you know, when he was playing you, he wanted to beat the crap out of you. That was always his thing.
Literally.
I mean.
Physically.
Yeah.
Tommy Lasorda almost killed me once.
Did you deserve it?
I think I've told this story like 7 times. Yeah. I basically have realized in my life, I have like 4 stories, period. Like I pretty much have like 4 stories and I just rotate them. And I think I tell them all like at least twice a week. I don't know. I'm not that interesting of a person. I just think I have like a handful of things I talk about. But yeah, 2006, I was at the World Baseball Classic and I came around a corner in front of an open garage door on the ground floor of a hotel. And I heard this screeching sound, and it was Tommy Lasorda in a golf cart slamming on the brakes in order to not run over me and my friends. He might have been the passenger.
And I'm sure he was very nice about it, too. Yeah.
Either way, I was almost killed by Tommy Lasorda. So, now you know. But that really is a very fascinating question. And we're going to open that up to you guys on Twitter during the game, probably tomorrow, because on an off day, we don't really get as much traffic, obviously, from people being tuned in and logged on. But I think that would be interesting to get everybody's take on who on this roster would be the best fit for that role, because that's a great topic.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't think it could happen in this day and age. I think it would be very, very tough to juggle all the aspects of being a major league manager at this point and then continue to play the game at a high level. I think that'd be very, very tough to do. You'd have to be a part-time player, like someone like Jason Giambi in his last couple years in the big leagues, like where he's really, really just a pinch hitter, you know? He might get like maybe 1 or 2 starts a month. Someone like that, I could see it where they're very, very part-time. But at the same time, then you're wasting a roster spot, ostensibly. So I don't know. I love the question. Love the debate. I think it's a lot of fun. I wonder if it could happen. I don't think so. But who knows if we'll ever see it again. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. It would be very, very cool. And it is a really neat thing to kind of bounce around in your head. And not only on the Rockies, but to think about it on other teams. It's kind of cool to think about. There is some new – I mean, obviously, Rockies dropped 2 out of 3 from the Texas Rangers yesterday. Very frustrating. Bullpen collapse late in a game that the Rockies came back to tie. They very nearly blew a 7-0 lead in their only win of the series. So, you know, we're kind of into the doldrums.
They did blow the lead.
Well, they did blow
the
lead.
And then they won
the
game.
Yeah. They very nearly took the loss.
Yeah.
But you know, we're in the doldrums of a Rockies season. I mean, let's call a spade a spade right now. Like this is what we're used to. So that's not fun. But you know, trade deadline comes up a week from Friday on the 31st. And, we'll have some discussion about that obviously next week. But in the meantime, there is some other news. David Dahl is back playing. Dahl has returned to AA New Britain. Since then, he's been pretty good already, and multi-hit games, running balls down to the outfield, does not seem to be suffering any ill effects from having his spleen removed after that collision on May 28th.
Think about that for
ruptured.
A second. No ill effects from having his spleen removed.
Yeah. Ugh. Yikes. He told the Bristol Press newspaper, quote, "It was the smartest decision to get rid of it because if I'd kept it, I would have had to miss the rest of the season, and then I'd have to wear some protective stuff. Now I go out and play and not worry about it." You're a badass, David Dahl.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, That's awesome.
Since going back to the Eastern League after, you know, getting his first couple of games back with Boise, he's hitting .391 in the first 6 games with the Rock Cats. 3 doubles. He's got 2 stolen bases. He's got 4 runs scored, 9 hits. He's OPSing over 1,000. I mean, this kid is a stud. And he's
good at baseball.
Yeah. And he's only 21 years old, and he is sans spleen. And the more he gets comfortable with it, He's spleenless.
Spleen-free.
The more he gets comfortable with being spleen-free, he's only going to get better. He's going to be what he was at the beginning of the year, which isn't ridiculous. Like, how do you not love David Dahl?
Yeah, he is a whole pile of fun, David Dahl. It's really good to just see. It's just good to see him back, period. I mean, even if he finished the year slow, you would think, like, well, at least he got back out there. But it's just really good to see him back and healthy.
Speaking of guys coming back, Corey Dickerson is on the rehab trail, good to see. He is in AAA right now, I believe.
He started his rehabs in Modesto.
He's played a couple of games now with the Isotopes. I almost said the Sky Sox. it's weird.
That's weird, my game. Like weird, mixing up affiliates is my
weird
game.
Weird vertigo there. but he's got a couple hits in seven at-bats with the Sky Sox so far. So, and he was hitting pretty well with Modesto in his couple of appearances there. So
stole home.
Yeah, he did. He had three hits and eight at-bats in two games. So he could be activated by this weekend is the rumor that we heard. So that would be awesome if he can get back in the fold. And, you know, Tapia is still hitting .323.
Shocker. Raimel Tapia is hitting?
Yeah.
I cannot believe it.
What's cool, though, is that Ryan McMahon is really coming on as of late as well.
Very hot as of late.
His average up to .301 on the season. He is in the month of July hitting .333 with five home runs and a .1032 OPS. So he's up to 12 home runs on the year, 29 doubles as well. The OPS on the year up to .898.
And again, another guy is pretty young for the level.
Yeah, I mean, he is only 20. He doesn't turn 21 until December, and he's playing in the high A ball right now.
Man, there's a lot of talent. There's a lot of talent
and
on that roster.
Trevor Story.
Antonio Sensatella. Trevor Story's
Story
been killing it lately,
too. Having a heck of a time starting
out. Good futures game appearance.
Yeah. I mean, he is so far hitting .261 with five home runs, 11 driven in, 13 extra base hits out of his 18 hits, I should say, in AAA so far. But he's got multiple hits in three of his last four games. He had a two home run game on Tuesday. He had a two home run game. He had two doubles in last night's contest. So the average is climbing. He's striking out about once a game, which is pretty much par for the course for Trevor Story, but he's hitting the ball with power in a good ballpark to do so. OPS almost 900. So Trevor Story still, guys, just 22 years old and currently doing very, very well in AAA. So just keep that in mind.
And what position does he play?
I mean, he plays shortstop. But to be fair, he has played shortstop, second base, and third.
Yeah, yeah.
He has played, 16 at-bats at second base, 18 at third, and 35 at short. So he's pretty much going around between the three positions, which is basically what you want for a utility infielder, which I imagine we will see him in that role with the Colorado Rockies before the end of the season.
All right. I like that prediction. By the way, did you see Cargo throw his glove at the ball yesterday?
Yes.
It was so great. It was a foul ball that I don't even know what the hell happened. It bounced around. It kind of rattled around in that right field corner and came out on the warning track. And Cargo was running after it, trying to cut it off. And it was just like, oh, screw this. And threw his glove at the ball. And that was before everything went to hell.
Yeah. That's adorable.
Game in the ninth. Yeah. Oh, this is fun. Oh, and it's not fun anymore. Yeah. Womp womp. So there are some things, you know, to keep an eye on prospect-wise, and we're going to talk a lot more about the Big League Club, obviously, next week, and we will
hope there's stuff to talk about.
Hopefully have some things to talk about. But coming up next, we're going to step back in time and talk about one of the big pre-Big League moments of Denver baseball history and a whole lot of other stuff from this very awesome, amazing series of stories called Nine Innings that Benjamin Hockman has been putting together for the Denver Post. Our good pal Ben joins us next. Really pumped to have our good pal Benjamin Hockman join the show for the first time in the 2015 season, I think. Welcome back, Ben.
Thanks. How you doing?
Good. How about you?
I am awesome.
Okay, good. Because the work that you have done over the last, man, this goes back now a couple of months, but the nine-inning series that you have done for the Post so far this year, the seventh inning will be coming up here later on this week, but they are nine stories about Denver's love of baseball, people in Denver, and their connection with baseball. It's incredible. The stories that you've uncovered are amazing. And first of all, I mean, just how did this process come about? How did you come up with this idea, and what was the thinking that went into it and putting it all together?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, absolutely.
And, of course, I love you guys' podcast. Yeah, let's talk about this. I basically always wanted to tell stories that haven't been told in regards to baseball in Colorado. And I didn't – at first I was like, maybe I should just do one piece and do nine innings of a game. And literally, like, the first inning I'm at a Rockies game, the second inning I'm at a Sky Sox game, third inning I'm at a high school, what have you, and make it all one piece. But then we just – you know, I started doing a bunch of research and kept finding these just fascinating stories. And I was like, why don't we do nine feature stories? It's just funny how the thing's grown. Like, the first one was supposed to be like, we do like a normal column that I write in the Denver Post is 20 inches. Well, these were supposed to be like 40 inches, you know, double. And then I wrote the first one, it was like 80 inches. And now I'm getting in triple digits. So the thing's just growing each time I write one.
Ben, no, the most recent one is the Joey Meyer story, and that story is so close to my heart because it was something that I heard about a lot as a kid. I wrote about it from MILB.com last year. Your story dives so much more into the mystery surrounding what happened to the actual seat that he hit, which so many people, myself very much included, did not even put together that the seat the Rockies have in their archives, the seat that was kind of always rumored to be the one from Joey Meyer's nearly 600-foot home run back in 1987, was not actually the seat that he hit. Tell us about this one, because this one hits so close to home for me and for a lot of people, and it's such an awesome story.
I appreciate it. Yeah, my hair was dark brown in June, and now in July it's just gray. I mean, this thing drove me nuts, but in kind of like an obsessive, but ended up being a good way for the story. Basically, for those who don't know, in 1987, there was the Denver Zephyrs, the AAA team, and there was no humidor at Mile High Stadium. It just was what it was, and a big fat guy named Joey Meyer hit a home run that they estimated at 582 feet. It's become kind of a fish tale, a fish story here in Denver. People talking about, oh, did you see the Joey Meyer home run? There's only 1,000 people at the stadium, and it's not even on YouTube. Like, I had to go to one of the local TV stations just to get the video of it, and then you're watching the video, and the camera guy loses the ball. So, I mean, it's just like all these weird kind of like aspects to this thing of lore, this Joey Meyer home run. And I think what was also neat about it is that it wasn't hit by like Gary Sheffield or Barry Larkin or one of these Hall of Famers, Hall of Fame types that have played in Denver. It was kind of by like now a no-name, a guy who's like only known for this like, you know, superhuman home run. So I was like, everyone made a big deal about the seat it hit, because the Zephyrs apparently painted the seat right after the home run happened, so everyone would see how high in the second deck the ball hit. And you mentioned the Rockies archive, Paul Parker, super guy. He's a team historian, and I meet with him, and he takes me into the archive down there, and it's kind of like this hidden museum. And he's showing me all this stuff.
Which is actually what it was supposed to be. That area of Coors Field was supposed to be a Rockies and a Colorado baseball history museum, and it just never got turned into one.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. And especially the listeners of your podcast, you'll probably go nuts if I like told you all the cool stuff that's just hidden down there.
Correct. We would go nuts.
Display.
You should totally tell us about that.
I mean, for me, it was cool seeing like the champagne bottles from the NLCS, and they have the base that Tulowitzki made the unassisted triple play on, and just so many bats, and you know, a plethora of autographed balls, including one from Bob Feller, another from Joe DiMaggio, Ty Cobb. I mean, it's just this. They had the original Dinger costume, so I considered punching that to get my.
That's terrifying looking.
I hate. Yeah, I mean,
Dinger was somehow
Dinger
more frightening and awful, like in 1994.
How?
I don't know,
right,
but it's terrifying.
It was like kind of like a, this Dinger looked like it was like a high school art project, but not like the art students that are like going off to art school. You know, like the kids who like have to take an elective, so they take art and they're supposed to like put together some like paper mache mascot, and that's what the original Dinger looked like. He shows me the base, and it's blue. He goes, this is the seat that the ball hit. It's blue. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. This guy's a pretty smart guy, pretty respected guy. He's got the blue seat. But the more people I interviewed, they started telling me about a green seat. I'm like, well, maybe they think it's blue. And then I start hearing about an orange seat. And that's when my hair starts changing colors. I'm like, what is going on here? And basically what happened, long story short, or perhaps long story long, it turns out after a bunch of research that the home run hit yellow benches. And the benches were painted green, right, where the ball hit, so people would see it. And then in 1990 and 91, they did renovation at Mile High Stadium, and they replaced the yellow benches with blue seats. But then they took out one or two blue seats and replaced those with orange seats, so you could still look up and be like, oh, that's where the Joey Meyer home run hit. But obviously, the blue seat that was replaced, that went to the Rockies, and so they didn't get the seat that the ball actually hit. So where is that seat? I'm going nuts, right? And I'm calling, you know, dozens and dozens of people, and there's this guy they're talking about, Gary Jones. Gary Jones used to run Mile High Stadium. He'll know. And I can't find this guy everywhere. I'm calling important people. They don't know where he is. You can't just look up Gary Jones. There's, you know, a million of them in the phone book. Finally, I find my white whale, Gary Jones, this 70-year-old man. And he goes, oh yeah, I think they sent those down to a racetrack in Pueblo. I'm like, it was like the most random like thing to hear, a racetrack in Pueblo.
Yeah, yeah, that was one of the turns of the story that I loved.
Yeah, and I'm calling. So no, it's not at the main racetrack in Pueblo. So I end up calling basically first like anyone near Pueblo or any racetrack near Pueblo, then pretty much like any racetrack in the same state as Pueblo I'm calling. And long story now, super long, I couldn't find the dang thing. I couldn't find the seat, and I don't think anyone knows where it is or if it's even still out there or if it's been thrown away. But that's the way I ended the piece, was it kind of only adds to the lore and the mystery that is this home run. We don't know, the bat broke. We don't know where the ball is. We clearly don't know where the seat is. We don't even know if the home run really was 582 feet because, it's 1987. Basically, it's some guy standing at home plate going, yeah, it looks 582. Let's go with 582. That's basically what the math was back then. And then Mark Knudsen, the major league pitcher who pitched for the Zephyrs in 87, he goes, it's a known thing around baseball that in 1987 balls were juiced. And it's not just like this one thing that like this one, you know, bitter pitcher says. Well,
it's very famous that 87 was the one year in the 80s where the offense went crazy and then went back to just ridiculous amounts.
Yeah. Yeah. It was bonkers, man. Like, Mark McGwire and Andre Dawson hit 49 home runs. Yep. Wade Boggs, who never before or after hit more than 11 home runs, hit 24 that season. And another one in 1987. So in 86, home runs, there had never been more home runs hit in baseball than in the year 1986. Then in 87, that number went up 20%. I mean, it was just mind-boggling. So that only adds to it. It's like, all right, well, he hit the ball in 87. He's playing professional baseball. Maybe that ball was juiced. So, again, it just kind of leads to this crazy mystery that is this home run that everyone in Denver's heard of, or at least heard whispers about.
Yeah, you look at actually the totals in the 1980s. In 1987 in MLB, 4,458 home runs were hit, so almost 4,500 home runs. The next closest number of total home runs hit in a single season in the 1980s was about 3,800. So it's about 700 more home runs were hit in 1987, and that dropped all the way down to 3,180 the following season. 1,300 fewer homers were hit the next year in baseball. That juiced ball thing was – that's got some pretty good numbers behind that one, Ben.
Right,
one thing that
right,
I noticed
right.
when I was watching this, the video that you have on the article on DenverPost.com about the actual home run, the pitcher, Mike Murphy, he balks before that pitch. he does not come set. His hands never come set. There's a runner on base. He checks the runner. He brings his hands down. They never come set. He throws the pitch anyway, and then Meyer hits the home run. That was the first thing I noticed.
Whoa.
I thought that was absolutely fascinating.
What a find. I mean, so that just adds to it. Really,
yeah.
That pitch shouldn't have even have counted.
It shouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, that just only adds to it. And then there's always famous people involved. You know, he had three home runs that night. The first home run was against pitcher John Farrell, who ends up managing the Red Sox for the 2013 World Series title. And the bat Joey Meyer was using was an actual bat that belonged to Cal Ripken. And, you know, Otis Nixon's in center field. I mean, it's just bonkers.
You watch it, it's like watching the Zapruder film of JFK being shot. Like, it really is. You can watch it over and over again and find new things, and the more you find out about the story, the more fascinating it gets. Like how high does this go, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well said.
Ben, this series has been so, so cool. The Meyer story was the most recent one in the inning number 6. Now, the 7th inning is coming up later this week. But tell us about some of these other stories and how you came across them, because they're so deeply personal in so many regards. I mean, the story about Obi Sani, who I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but a Nigerian immigrant who basically has had a sponsored family help him get into baseball. His dad, his parents kind of didn't take the athletics route, but another family knew how much he loved baseball. They helped him, you know, kind of pursue that avenue. He's getting close to high school age, I guess. But, I mean, stories of people who you wouldn't necessarily hear otherwise. You've uncovered these really amazing stories. How have you come across so many of these?
You know, I mean, it's a very simple thing. It's going to sound almost stupid, but it's ask. I asked people, do they know any cool stories about baseball? And the whole point of this was I didn't want to do a story that our intern could do or anybody could just churn out. You know what I mean? I wanted to do some unique things. And so, for instance, I asked ushers at Coors Field if they knew of any people who are blind, can't see, but still come to Rockies games. And sure enough, we find married couple Mark and Peggy LaRusso. They're both blind. They've been married 30 years, and they literally are driven and attend dozens of Rockies games each year, and they can't see a thing. But they listen to the broadcast on their headphones, and they can smell the ballpark, and they can smell the grass, and they can hear the sounds, and all these other feelings come in, and they just love the heck out of baseball. And, you know, so I, you know, getting to know these people was just so amazing, an amazing experience, because they give you a perspective on your own fandom and what baseball really means to you. You mentioned Obi Sani, the second story, and we're talking about, I mean, you hear stories a lot, like Andrew McCutchen, you know, famously the Blind Side, where kids from not well-to-do family kind of get picked up by a well-to-do family, and because of that, they get the resources they need to become a star athlete. Well, the difference with this Obi Sani thing is, so Obi's family doesn't have much money and doesn't want to spend the money they have on baseball, but Obi didn't find, you know, the Michael Orr family. He found the Jennings family, who are kind of a, you know, blue-collar, middle-class family. They don't have much money either, but they recognize the importance of baseball, and they fell in love with Obi, and they essentially, you know, more or less adopted him. And they, you know, they don't go on vacations. They don't do many, like, fun family things because they spend their money on Obi and their own son to play baseball. It's just a beautiful thing. And you have some others with Lou Rotola, 81-year-old baseball player here in town, and then Eaton, Colorado. I always wanted to do a story, guys, about a town that just, like, churns out great baseball teams. You know, in Eaton, Colorado, every year they're in like the state finals. Tyler, I think you like played against that.
Yeah,
school,
well, I didn't actually play against them during my career, but they were always like, when I was in high school, they were like the Yankees. I mean, that was like, if you got a shot at Eaton, that was like big stuff. And then 2 years after I graduated high school, my team, I believe, actually defeated Eaton in the state semifinals. And that's like such a rarity that anybody takes out Eaton before a championship game. And that was, again, like, that's one of those things that not a whole lot of people know about that you uncovered, because it's true. That place just breathes baseball. And you would never really know that about a small town in Denver or in the Denver area, I guess.
Exactly. So a couple of things. I was like, all right, what are they? First of all, what are they doing up there? There's dozens of small towns that play baseball in Colorado. Why is this particular town winning every year? And then, also just to introduce the town to people who had never heard of it. And basically, I spent a bunch of time up there, and I'm getting to know. Basically, they have this program, and it's such a family-oriented program. And you start, it's all Eaton baseball. And you start when you're, 5, 6, 7 years old, and it's the old players who are your coaches, and it's this huge program, and it all leads up to 7. The guy nicknamed 7, Jim Danley, who wears the uniform number 7, not Costanza's baby or what have you. And we're talking about a genius baseball coach, Jim Danley, who basically teaches the knuckle curve at a young age, and it doesn't hurt the arm, and it's just such a family atmosphere to this. Another cool thing that really stood out to me was the idea of the hats, that you get a hat when you make, I think, like a third grade team, and it's a white hat with red pinstripes and has an E on it for Eton. And what players do is they keep that hat their entire run through the high school. And whenever their head grows, they just cut the back, and literally just cut the back of a fitted hat, and then it just makes it spread and expand. So the guys that are seniors on Eton, their white hats are actually brown, basically, because they've been, in dirt and dugouts for decades or what have you. And it's just another cool small-town aspect.
You didn't keep the 9-inning series just devoted to places around Colorado that you wouldn't necessarily know. You had one in, I believe, the 5th inning about LaTroy Hawkins. Now, Hawkins has been in baseball since 1995. He was drafted in the early 90s. What was one of the coolest things that you found out about LaTroy in the process of writing this article that you had no idea before?
Yeah, well, basically, like, I wanted, again, we didn't want to do any like cookie cutter stories like, right, oh, here's a good ball player. Like, we could have easily done Troy Tulowitzki or something, but to your question, like, I'd heard a lot of like neat things about LaTroy Hawkins, Rockies reliever, about him just being like a really cool person. And it's almost a cliche, like, oh, he's such a good person. Like, I think the Onion once did a story about like Ray Allen walks an old lady across the street, and Ray Allen, greatest human. Did you see what the athlete did? He helped an old lady across the street. You know, that type of thing. But LaTroy, it truly is like a great human being. And some of the stories we found out about him are just beautiful. Like he gets to know his team doctor's family to the point that every year at spring training, the doctor was based in Florida. Every year at spring training, he'd go to their house for dinner, and he would go to the little kid Sammy's baseball games or little league games. And one time, LaTroy got so fired up about a call, he got kicked out of a little league game, out of the stands. And LaTroy actually flew down to Florida for the kid's bar mitzvah when the kid was 13 years old, and there's LaTroy Hawkins. He's dancing at the party and just really getting involved. And I mean, and then how about this? The LaTroy Hawkins fan club. I don't know if your listeners know about this, but when LaTroy pitched for Minnesota, these fans started a fan club. All right, well, there's fan clubs for a bunch of players, right? But LaTroy would, after every game, he said, would stop and talk to those fans outside the tunnel where the team drove out every home game. He's got to know these people. Now he's in their lives. He's godfather to a child. He spoke at a wedding. He loaned his nice BMW to one of the fan club members who was going to prom. And another one of the fan club members, her mother was dying. So LaTroy goes and sees her. And then when she dies, they put LaTroy's autographed ball in her grave with her, in her casket. I mean, talk about like incredible stories. And he's just a great human. And there were so many stories like that. And oh, by the way, he's the oldest guy in baseball. And oh, by the way, he's on our team.
And I believe also Thomas Harding posted a link, I think yesterday, saying that LaTroy Hawkins is basically baseball's last remaining link to Michael Jordan's minor league career, which is kind of cool too. I mean, that's like how long LaTroy has been around, it's true. If you get in a conversation with LaTroy, you're the only person in the world that exists to him. And that's so rare, not just for athletes, but for people, you never come across those people. And the fact that, the Rockies, obviously a struggling team, whatever, it's tough to, just place things in like, oh, well, they're good guys. But when it's almost somebody who is a rarity in what a good person they are, it makes you appreciate it more that way. And that's a phenomenal, of all of these are so, so great. And that one is really, really cool. Just because it gives you a kind of personal take on somebody who is a public figure. A lot of the rest of this is personal takes on very personal people. But they're all just phenomenal. If you've not checked out this series yet, you have to go to DenverPost.com and search for the 9-inning series. They're incredible stories, incredible work by Ben. Nick, I know, helped out. Nick Groke helped out on the LaTroy Hawkins story. I don't want to give away the later ones, but I know the 7th inning is coming up this week. So tell us a little bit about what inning number 7 is going to be.
Yeah, it kind of self-explanatory. We were like, well, what should we do for the 7th inning? And someone's like, how about the 7th inning stretch? And so the idea is to kind of paint the picture of the 7th inning stretch. And at first I was like, 7th inning stretch is weird when you think about it. Like, what is the 7th inning stretch? Okay, we all go to a stadium and we're sitting there enraptured watching a game for 6.5 innings, and then suddenly we all stand up and sing a song.
And it's like we're all possessed by some weird alien ray for like 5 minutes. That's
yeah.
true.
And the song is about attending the very event we're at. We're already there. We don't need to go to the ball game. We're at the ball game. And then we're reaching up trying to catch 75-cent bags of Cracker Jack, and we're singing along to Hey Baby like it's our college alma mater. And then and then we all sit down, and the game continues. It's a very weird ritual, but it's our ritual, you know? And so I went to the AAA game, went to the 7th inning stretch. Of course, went to a couple Rockies games. I actually got to throw the Cracker Jacks out to the Rockies fans with Jack Corgan and Jerry Schimmel of KOA from the booth during the 7th inning stretch. So I did that. There's a part on Harry Carey and the great Nate Kreckman from Nate Kreckman from ESPN Denver. He's quoted in there talking about Harry Carey, and it's a fun piece, but there's also some poignant moments. You get to know some Rockies fans in there. So I like all of them. I'm very proud of the 7th inning and the 8th and 9th around the corner. So, yeah, I think if you just type in Denver Post and then search for 9 innings, you can get – they're all on one page. You know, just click on stories, pull it down, choose whichever one you want to jump into.
I mean, as a diehard Cardinals fan growing up, Ben, how did you feel about interviewing Nate Kreckman for this, considering he is a diehard Cubs fan, and the fact that when people think of the 7th inning stretch in America now, they kind of think of Harry Carey. He kind of co-opted the most famous part of it. I mean,
former
what are your
Cardinals broadcaster Harry Carey as well, who's not really known for.
No, but do you think about the Cubs and Harry Carey kind of co-opting that for the rest of America?
That is a great question, but I look at it this way. I'm like, all right, Nate's team, my rival team, their most famous member is a broadcaster. our most famous member is Sam Musial, Lou Brock, you know, Bob Gibson, Ozzie Smith. Which Hall of Fame World Series winner do you want me to name? Albert Pujols, perhaps, you know, et cetera. And Nate also actually gave some good quotes, and you know, I'm interviewing him and he's using these. I'm like, do you have a thesaurus? Like, he knew I was going to interview. I think he like just went to a thesaurus and got all the big words.
His quotes are very
use.
Impressive.
They
I know.
Really
like,
are.
We've hung out with Nate Kreckman for a long time. I've never heard him use big words before. It's very impressive quotes.
Yeah, like it reminds me of the one time I interviewed. You know, you seldom interview like the worst player on the Nuggets. But I think Ronaldo Balkman got some playing time, and I interviewed him. And the Nuggets assistant coach came up to me the next day and goes, how did you get him to speak in complete sentences? Similar to the Kreckman.
Here's the best Nate Kreckman quote here. In the day and age of team broadcaster as de facto team salesman, it's hard to remember there was a time when broadcasters like Harry lambasted lousy play or opined about exorbitant contracts for underperforming players.
Yeah, I go, Nate,
which
are you
is
sure
awesome.
You're using that correctly, lambasted? He's like, oh, yeah, definitely lambasted. But that happened with you, Tyler. I interviewed, a little behind the curtain here. I interviewed Tyler for the Joey Meyer piece because Tyler is a diehard baseball guy from Denver, to put it all in perspective. And you used Harbinger. And then I was like, wait.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you're like, Wow. It was kind of like an old school when Will Ferrell does the debate and he like passes out where he does it and like is speaking eloquently. And then they're like, he's like, what just happened? I passed out. I think that was you when you were doing the interview with me. You're like, oh, it's like a harbinger.
I was so surprised. I felt it like it. I felt it coming on at the last second. And I was like, I think I'm going to say this big word and I don't know how to do it right. I was pretty impressed with the whole thing. We were also just being like verbally accosted by a homeless guy in that day. We had a very fun lunch.
Did you deserve it?
Well, that lunch. Yeah, I mean, we're sitting outside a sushi place on Broadway, and this gentleman comes up to us, and he appeared not to be homed, and he asked us if he could use one of our phones. First, he asked us for money, of course, but then he asked us to use one of our phones to like call somebody, I think like his parole officer, whatever. And of course,
yeah,
we
was
declined.
Like calling about a court date or something. And yeah. and we walked away. Ben was like, "Does he just like have the number to the court memorized? Like,
right.
Is this a thing that he does regularly?"
If he does, then it's
but,
probably.
But my question to Tyler
more
and everybody
of his, the rest of his life.
Oh yeah.
It was a big heart.
I'm sorry. My question was how would it have played out if we had handed him the phone?
Yeah, like, right.
What are the possibilities? Like, he would have just started running. He would have, like, dialed 911 and be like, courts, please. Like, I mean.
Can you guys put me in touch with the court?
Like, I've actually done that before. And whenever it's happened and I've, you know, sized them up, I give them the phone. And then I'm, like, in, like, a three-point stance ready to go in case they even make the slightest movement to run. And if they do,
yeah.
I will have no problem tackling them and beating the crap out of them for my phone back.
Because that's what we were talking about. It's like, I wish I had enough money to just give the guy my phone, and then if he ran off of the phone, I could just get another phone. But just for the social experiment,
like,
of what is this guy going to do?
I like 50% of the time, I hope they just start running, and I can be like, all right, I know I can catch them too.
See, I'm the slowest person on earth, so I wouldn't be able to catch anyone.
But it's interesting because like he might just make a call. Like, he might actually do it, or he might do something absurd, and it reminds me of Fly to the Conchords. Remember that old show on HBO?
Yeah.
They did a thing where this was in the mid-2000s, and you know, remember we would get those emails like, the prince of some country you've never heard of needs
Nigeria,
your help.
Yeah.
Nigeria needs your help and assistance financially. he swears if you can help him from this jam, you know, he'll be indebted to you. And like, you know, the percent number of people that wrote back that had to be zero. Like, even the dumbest Americans not going to be like, I know what I'll do. Oh, that's great they found me because I'm a nice guy and I'll send my money tonight. So, but on Fly of the Conchords, it like played out, and sure enough, like this like prince of Nigeria like came and like helped them out and was forever indebted to them. So that'd be like the actual thing happened. That'd be like us handing the phone to the homeless person and him actually dialing the number for the courts and like, hello, my name is John Stevens. Yes, I have a court date in 4 days. I wanted to make sure I had the time right. Okay, thank you. And then handing it back to us and saying, enjoy your sushi, guys. Have a good day.
And then he like goes and it runs all the way up to the Supreme Court and he ends up like overturning Citizens United. And then we're just all heroes for having lended him the phone that one day. It all came out of that one.
Phone.
He like took down the Koch brothers. Yeah,
that'll be the 10th inning or something. We'll contact that guy. It'll be the 10th inning, but it'll be a legal story born out of a baseball story. Why not?
I think we have a harbinger on our hands.
Benjamin Hockman is on Twitter at Hockman. And seriously, if you have not read the 9-inning story so far, the 7th inning comes out this week. This is one of my favorite. This paragraph in inning number 6 in the Joey Meyer story is one of the best things I have ever read, and it shows you all of the reporting that went into this story. And I'm gonna read you one paragraph, and okay, you can kind of just tell how far Ben took this in chasing down these bleachers. He said, I was losing sleep, my mind too. I called Gary Jones again, that's a guy from Mile High, and he then remembered that some of the bleachers were also sold at the time. He even said the name of the company, American Seating, which of course sounded fake, but it wasn't. And an old guy there put me in touch with a guy in New Jersey named Steve, who put me in touch with a guy in Illinois named Grant, who was actually on the job at Mile High in 1990 and 91. Grant couldn't remember exactly where they were, but possibly Tennessee? That's how much work went into this story. Like, this is incredible. It's incredible. And it's just like, it's one of my favorite. I texted Ben the day it came out and I was like, dude, everything new you write is my new favorite thing that Benjamin Hockman has written. It's all so awesome. We cannot plug this series enough because it's so great. And Ben, you should be super proud. And Nick, too, for helping you out with the LaTroy story. They're phenomenal. And this is such awesome work, man.
Yeah, you guys are so kind to say that. I appreciate it, Ty. And yeah, just like I'm writing this for baseball fans. This is for the listeners. It's for you guys. I'm glad you guys are enjoying it and hope everybody else is.
You know what's funny, too, is I was, like, so excited to read the entire thing that I read it on my phone, and I'm just now, for the first time, looking at it on the Post site, and I did not realize that there's, like, a whole paragraph about our lunch. Was that where Harbinger is? Harbinger actually
in there? You didn't know
I missed that entire thing. I knew I was in like the first, like the opening part where I was talking about Joey Meyer. And by the way, the way that Ben describes this as like a fish story is the perfect categorization for this, especially because until we saw the video, it really was just sort of one of those things where it's like people just talked about it. And that's how it got. Right. It was like, oh, Joey Meyer hit this home run, hit it into the upper deck, hit it way back into the upper deck. It broke a chair. Like it just kept growing. And that's what it's so awesome. This story is just so well put together, and they all are. I mean, they're all that way. It's not just the baseball stuff. It's the human interest stuff, and it's I could go for the next half hour just talking about how phenomenal the series is all on my own, but it's Ben, you should be super proud, man, because we're very lucky to have you in this town, and this is really, really cool stuff.
I sincerely appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That Ben is so, so good at this stuff.
Yes.
And I texted you in the middle of this and said, like, he's like the perfect podcast guest because he's so entertaining. He's very talkative. The way he tells stories, a lot of people can write but can't talk. And a lot of people who can do both are like a little bit too bloviated, and it's like a heavy subject matters and it's whatever. But Ben is so approachable, and when he tells those stories, you can feel the passion that he has for the stuff that he writes. He makes them come alive for you. And these stories are some of the best journalism that we've had in Denver in a very, very long time.
100%.
And they're so great. They're also great. Now, here's the crazy thing. So Ben solved a mystery.
Yes.
Ben put together and solved a mystery.
Ben is like one of the Hardy Boys.
I know, basically, that many people, myself included, completely missed. I wrote a story for MILB.com about the Meyer story. I kind of talked a little bit more about how Joey Meyer lost the ball and the seat and his jersey and all that stuff. He thought that he was going to be getting it when they tore down Mile High Stadium, and instead it ended up with the Rockies. He didn't even know that. But his son just one day happened to be walking through the National Ballpark Museum on Blake Street and saw them in there and called his dad. It was like, Dad, I found the ball that you hit. I found the bat, whatever. And so that's kind of the tack that I took, but I went to the archives, I saw the seat, took pictures of the seat, put that in there. That's a seat that Joey Meyer hit, whatever. Now, Ben, being actual good reporter, unlike me, Ben noticed in the photo that Joey Meyer is standing in the second level of Mile High Stadium in a section of bleachers. I did not even really think about it. You can see the two rows of seats in front of him are bleachers.
Yeah.
The row that he is standing in, you can't really see what's there as far as seats go, but obviously it's a section of bleachered seats. So they didn't have the Mile High Stadium seats that you probably remember from when you were a kid. They didn't have those yet in that level. And also the fact that they were yellow, I find very interesting too, that the Broncos played there, but they had yellow seats for some reason.
Yeah, I'm not really sure about that.
That's
sure
kind of strange.
Why that happening.
Ben thought, well, then it couldn't be the seat. And so it turned into this massive mystery of what are these bleachers and how did this move from being, okay, it was bleachers that they painted green at the time, and then all of a sudden it was seats, and they had one orange seat and a section of blue seats, and how Ben figured it out. It really is. It's like a Hardy Boys. He's like Henry and Ribsy. And it's such good work. And the thing I love most is there is a team photo that Ben found that confirmed it for him. The 1987 team photo was taken looking up at the left field stands, and above Rich Tombstone Jackson's name in the Ring of Fame, there is a very obviously painted green section of bleachers.
Yes.
And it's just
three seats,
so
right?
Two cool.
Seats,
three
maybe?
Seats, I think. Yeah. And just did some of the best work that I have read, especially as it pertains to Denver sports, in a very, very long time. And we can't thank Ben enough. That was so much fun. And not only that, he's got right now six other stories that are just as good.
Yeah.
And two more to come.
We're gonna go extra innings, I think. Yeah,
I hope. I hope he just starts an extra inning. I just did that as if like we were on a talk show. I just like drank out of my little Izzy sparkling apple soda, and then just started talking after.
I also like the fact that...
But I do. I just hope he goes into an extra inning series.
That we have a signed photo of Joey Meyer next to the team photo.
Yeah.
And Joey Meyer has impeccable handwriting.
Yeah. Tanner Joey Meyer Jr. And that signature is better than any signature that I have ever signed in my entire life.
Yes. By the way, Joey Meyer did make it to the big leagues for a couple of years. He played 156 games in 88 and 89, hit 18 home runs, drove in 74, an OPS of 716, a 251 average. OPS 800 against lefties in his career, though, with 9 home runs. But
he was
could not play after the 89 season.
He was kind of taken down by injuries. Yeah. And, you know, one of the things when I talked to Joey, and I think he said a lot of the same stuff to Ben, is he didn't really have the career that he thought he was going to have, that most people projected for him. I mean, Joey Meyer, I don't want to compare him this way, but in a lot of regards, he was almost like Giancarlo Stanton or Joey Gallo, just full-on power prospect. And these were in the days of the Brewers in the American League. So he was a DH prospect that the Brewers thought was going to provide mass power to inject into their lineup throughout the 90s. And it just didn't happen that way. And so many of those guys, that's what happens. So many guys suffer through those careers where it's just one thing after another. And, you know, for Joey, he was so big that I think once one thing in your body breaks down when you're that size, it leads to so much else. But he said to Ben, he told me the same thing, that he just appreciates being remembered for something now. And that was one of the things he said Cal Ripken said in his retirement speech was, if you can make an impact on one life, if you can be remembered for one thing, then that's an accomplishment. And he said, being remembered for this is very cool. For a while, I was kind of like, why do I have to keep talking about a home run I hit 20 years ago? And now that it's almost 30 years ago, he very much appreciates that people still call, people still track him down and say, you know, tell me about that night, you know? And seriously, go on to DenverPost.com and watch the video, because it's like, as I told Anthony before we started recording today, it's like a Blake Griffin dunk. Yeah. Like I cannot stop replaying.
You want to know what's really cool? Of his 18 career home runs, Joey Meyer had a walk-off in his career, walk-off home run on August 9th, 1988 for the Milwaukee Brewers playing against the Boston Red Sox. His walk-off home run came against none other than Roger Clemens.
No way.
Yeah. That's 3-2 awesome. Brewer victory in that game. Joey Meyer's one hit was a walk-off home run in the ninth inning off Roger Clemens. How about that?
That is a really good little nugget you found there. But also, I would imagine that the celebration was markedly different, because I feel like the mob scene of walk-offs just started like when we were like in middle school. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if you see video of like walk-offs from like the 50s and 60s, they're like three guys greet the guy at home plate with a handshake and that's it.
Yeah.
Except for like Bill Mazeroski in the World Series. Everybody's just like, okay, good job. Let's go to the shower.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Walk-off home run against Roger Clemens.
Against Roger Clemens. That's awesome.
How about that?
But it's such a cool story, and all of these stories are amazing, and we cannot thank Ben enough, and Nick Roque also for the work that he's done for this series, helped out with that the LaTroy Hawkins piece, and just phenomenal stuff. And we rag a lot on some things at the Post that we don't necessarily agree with, but we plug the things that we do believe are extremely good work, and this is at the top of the list. So a huge thanks to Ben for coming on with us. We're going to wrap up the show today.
Yeah, Rocky's heading on the road to Chicago to play the Cubs and St. Louis, where they've had a lot of success in their careers.
Yeah, always good.
Whole franchise history. They've played really, really well in Wrigley and at Busch Stadium. So
before they get that, they get the Cincinnati Reds at home. And so Anthony and I, backstory, worked in the minor leagues. I don't know if we've ever mentioned that before.
Nah, never.
But the Reds come to town, and they have a player on their roster named one J.J. Hoover. And Hoove was a good pal of ours for that entire season. I've kept in touch with Hoove a little bit since then. I went and saw him in the clubhouse last year. But here's my mission for this week. Last year, Hoove tweeted out a picture from a breakfast place downtown and said it was his favorite breakfast stop in the league. And I'm not going to dump all over a breakfast place, but it's not even the best breakfast place in downtown Denver. So my goal this week is to take Hoove to like an actual good breakfast place.
That would be cool.
Because I feel like he deserves a legit. I'm going to take him to Sam's number three because I know that Hoove could eat like seven burritos there.
Oh, my God, he could. I could eat seven burritos at Sam's number three. I mean, come
Hoove,
on.
He used to eat two Chipotle burritos, I think, at the same time. Not shoving them into his mouth at the same time, but I think he would eat like two per meal.
Yeah.
He's a giant.
But J.J. Hoover was also the first person who introduced me to sushi. We had a rain
really?
Out. Yeah, we had a rain out, and the two of us, Hoove and one other player, went
probably
out
Matt
to a sushi place. First time I'd ever had it before, but I wanted to seem cool and be like, yeah, I've totally had sushi.
No,
guys,
I'm totally into
great.
Sushi.
And now I eat it all the time. I love
really?
It. Yeah.
That's a good story.
Yeah.
By the way, what is going on outside my apartment right now? Can you hear this?
Nope. That's all you, dude.
It's like a, I don't know. It's like a trash can mixed with like a tornado. I don't know what's happening.
Trash can NATO. It's the Sharknado 4.
Oh, man. Next week on the show, we are hoping to catch up with the Boise Hawks. We were supposed to do that this week. Schedules changed, but we are hoping to run through our final minor league affiliate of your Colorado Rockies, the Class A short season Boise Hawks. Bob Flannery, the general manager, will hopefully join us next week, really just because I want to ask him about the blimp.
I mean, that's the first and only question we need to ask.
Sun blocking.
So, hey, what's up with the blimp?
So, okay, is the blimp working, or what's the blimp status there?
Yeah.
How about your blimps? But hopefully, we will be catching up with Bob Flannery next week of the Boise Hawks, and we'll have some baseball to talk about as well.
For next Friday, hopefully, when we do this actual show, it's going to be just past the trade deadline. Hopefully, there will be some changes to be made for the Colorado Rockies and some things to talk about because. You know, the last few Rockies trade deadlines, there hasn't been a lot of chatter.
Few, meaning like 15.
Ugh. Yeah.
Ugh.
Ugh.
Ugh. Ugh. Oh, my God. You're drunk. You're drunk.
I mean, it is almost noon here, so that's fair. And I have the next 2 days off, so give me a break.
Do you really?
Yeah. Actually, going back to Wyoming next Saturday, so that's why I want to get the podcast done on Friday, because the lady and I are heading back for 6 days.
How does she put up with you?
Dude, she's a saint, man. I have no idea.
We follow each other on Twitter now, and it's probably just going to degenerate into us making fun of you. No, she's so sweet.
She is.
Your girlfriend's so sweet. She's one of those people who, like, when I try to make fun of you, she's like, no, he's a good person, and I'm like, damn it, I know.
Yeah.
She's like, she tells me the things that I secretly feel about you, my love.
But you wouldn't... Gross.
This has gone so disturbingly off the rails.
Never, ever tell out loud.
It's such an emotional podcast.
It's such an emotional harbinger. I'm just using that
I like big
completely
words.
The wrong way now all the time.
Yeah, let's just use it all. And I did use it the correct way because that was the thing I said. When I finished the sentence, I said, wow, I think I actually used that right too. I like broke out my thesaurus. Yeah, no, I was very impressed for having used it the correct way as well.
Yeah.
Go read the 9-inning series. Follow Anthony on Twitter. He's at Mastertones. You can follow me. I'm at Tyler Mon. The podcast is at Purple Dinocast. Benjamin Hockman is on Twitter. He is at Hockman. And as always, our big thanks to our friends at ESPN Denver for hosting the podcast, as well as our pals at Purple Row for hosting the podcast. And until next week.
And buy our shirts. Humble Monster.
Yeah, buy our shirts. HumbleMonster.com.
We got new designs coming up, I swear.
We do. They are submitted, and I did hear back from Tyler. And so we have a couple in the works as of right now.
Wait, your Tyler.
And, yeah, from... Well, the other one. You're Tyler. Y-O-U-R. What?
Yes. Humble Monster, go check out our shirts there. We've got some new works. They're going to be awesome. Hopefully, fingers crossed, they may have something to do with Joey Meyer.
Possibly. That was one of the concepts that was in our little list. And there will be some – yeah, we're going kind of more Denver baseball history with the new stuff. So,
you mean like too low?
Too low.
It's going to be history. Am I right?
Danielle Jeffries, who I mentioned last week on the podcast, told me about a thing that I don't think actually exists, but she's positive exists. Was this something that people did where when the too low thing happened, they would put up like the peace sign, like two, and then they would turn it upside down? Like too
when
low?
Too low first started?
Like when the, I guess when like the chant first started, which I started the Tulo chant at the end of, I want you all to know, I was unemployed the summer after I graduated college and my friends and I used to go down to Coors Field and it was Troy Tulowitzki's rookie year. And I want you to know that I started the Tulo thing. I am 100%
I totally believe
convinced.
You.
I'm 100% positive. That
I 100%
I
believe you.
I don't think anybody does, but I do.
Yeah, I totally believe
but
you.
Is that, was that a thing that people did?
I do not know that.
I don't think it was a thing.
I don't think so.
She says it was. She's smarter than I am, but I never did it. And so I'm like, nope, didn't happen. I didn't do it. Nope. Because I'm a moron like that. All right, we're going to wrap up this edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Give us a follow. Give us a like. Give us whatever you got. And until next week, when this could be a different looking baseball team, we'll talk to you then. Bye.
Bye.
I'm recording. All right.
So,
three, two, one.